Well, a Gallup poll this week did find that birth control is not a top election issue for voters in the U.S. They're more concerned about health care, unemployment, and the deficit. Despite recent news, you might remember in Congress there was that failed Blunt Amendment, which would have allowed any employer, not just religious-based organizations, to opt out of the health care reform requirement that their plan provide free contraceptives for employees. And then Rush Limbaugh called that Georgetown Law School student a slut after she spoke in favor of birth control coverage for medical purposes. A Bloomberg poll found that almost 70% of women say access to birth control is a matter of health care. So, quick, if you're under 30, when was the pill invented? It's sometimes easy to forget how recent these tensions are. Today, we want to get a primer on the history of the pill. Did you know, for instance, that it was banned in Massachusetts until 1970? With us is Andrea Tone. She's professor of history and Canada research chair in the social history of medicine at McGill University in Montreal. Andrea, welcome.
Thank you. I'm glad to be here.
Take us back. What were some of the forms of birth control that people were using prior to the pill? I mean, we know that, you know, there was the rhythm method. In ancient Greece, frankincense oil was used. What was a womb veil, though?
A womb veil is a reference to what we would now call a cervical cap or diaphragm. We do sometimes forget that the pill has only been around for a little over 50 years, but people around the world, not just in the United States, have been using birth control methods for centuries. The oldest reference to one actually dates back to 1850 BC, and it involves a recipe for a vaginal suppository using crocodile dung. But that doesn't mean that some of the earlier methods were safe or effective or aesthetically desirable.
In 1873, the Federal Comstock Act was passed. Now, what did that say?
Yeah, the Comstock Act was a federal law passed in March of 1873 by Congress, which prohibited the interstate distribution of contraceptives. It was part of a much larger anti-obscenity law. It singled out anything that could be classified by people at that time as an obscene item. But it was a really important law in that it was the very first time in American history that Congress decisively enacted a statute to try to limit the circulation of contraception.
And so people like Julius Schmidt had to work underground. He was the German immigrant who began making condoms with surplus animal intestines. He worked at a sausage company.
Yes, yes. Even when birth control is criminalized, there's still a demand for birth control, and individuals such as Julius Schmidt meet that demand by making, in Schmidt's case, illegal condoms by stitching together the casings that he was able to get from animal intestines. The problem is that it wasn't regulated. Once you criminalize something, that means that you don't have a legitimate way to have a government agency stepping in to say, okay, this guy's condoms, they're safe. This person's womb veil isn't.
So we fast forward in a bit. In the 1930s, condoms are legalized. And there's also a character on the scene, Margaret Sanger. Now, she ran afoul of the Comstock Law early on. Who was Margaret Sanger?
A lapsed Catholic, very dedicated activist. She was an obstetrical nurse and had worked with very poor immigrant women in the Lower East Side. And from that experience, felt that it was absolutely essential to the well-being of poor women, but even all women, to be able to have female-controlled birth control methods. So Sanger comes along and opens up the very first birth control clinic in Brooklyn in 1916, and she's shut down through the Comstock laws.
So her first clinic is shut down in 1916, but she opens another one in 1923. This one stays open. It will become, over years, Planned Parenthood as we know it today. But take us from the 1930s to the 1950s. What was the thinking in general about birth control by the 1950s?
Yes, but there's still a lot of opposition against birth control. When we look at the late 1950s, we find that Margaret Sanger and some other individuals, many of them wealthy, are working privately to try to develop a better form of birth control. But one of the big changes, and Sanger was instrumental in having it happen, was that the government finally stepped in and said, if a device prevents something bad medically, then we will acknowledge that it has a legal right to be dispensed. If a birth control device prevents a pregnancy that could be viewed as medically dangerous, we will also accept the legal legitimacy of that use of birth control. Condoms were decriminalized because of the public health disaster that occurred in World War I, where the United States told soldiers that they could not use condoms, that condoms were bad news. And of course, the net result of that policy was that the United States government ended up spending millions on the treatment of men who succumbed to different venereal diseases. So from the 19-teens all the way up to the late 1950s, we're seeing a kind of thawing of people's very strict views about birth control, but it's still a kind of uneven patchwork quilt.
Let's talk about that, because the bulk of the 50s is made up of this, you know, it's almost like a thriller of how Margaret Sanger, who's now about 70-something years old in 1951, decides that there's got to be some sort of magic pill, literally her words. And she goes around and enlists scientists in this effort to find one.
Yes, she does. She was able to find a donor, a woman, Catherine Dexter McCormick, to basically single-handedly fund the development of the pill. She was able to handpick some of the top scientists who were doing work in this area. So, yes, it's a really interesting era in a kind of mobilization of ideas and resources and individuals to unite behind better birth control.
And the discovery is that a combination of estrogen and progesterone reduces health problems like bleeding, can more regulate the period. And so the first birth control pill was used, what, to help people with menstrual disorders?
Absolutely, yep. And it was put on the market in 1957. And the company that did this, G.D. Searle, did it because it was really anxious about what kind of response the pill would get. This was the first time that women had been invited to take a medication that neither prevented nor treated a disease. And people weren't sure if women would buy it, if doctors would prescribe it. So it was put on the market in 1957 as a medication to help women who were suffering from menstrual disorders. And then what was absolutely fascinating is it practically flew off the shelves. Within 2.5 years, over 100,000 women in the United States suddenly developed menstrual disorders.
Funny how that happened. Well, 3 years later, in 1960, the FDA approved the pill for contraceptive use. And again, the language was for health reasons, to avoid unwanted pregnancies that could be dangerous for physical or emotional reasons. The language wasn't about women having control over their bodies or being liberated. By 1963, 2.3 million women are using the pill. In 1965, the Supreme Court ruled against a Connecticut law that prohibited contraception. But there were still hitches. One was that the early pill had side effects, which have since been reduced. We're getting a brief history of the birth control pill. We've moved from the early 1900s when couples would use euphemisms in talking about procuring some kind of contraception because it was illegal, to 1957 when a pill was introduced to control menstrual disorders, to 1960 when it was approved as a contraceptive. In the 60s, President Lyndon Johnson pushed for legislation for federal support of birth control for the poor, even though before him, President Eisenhower said the government should not be involved in birth control. In 1970, President Nixon signed the Title X Family Planning Program as part of the Public Health Services Act, meaning the government would help subsidize contraceptives for low-income people. They'd be available regardless of income. He had the famous phrase, contraceptives for all. So the tide was shifting, as Dr. Andrea Tone of McGill University in Montreal, Canada, has been telling us. But Andrea, as the pill gained popularity, there were safety concerns. In 1969, Dr. Barbara Seaman published a book about side effects. They included the risk of blood clots and heart attacks. Now, we should say today's pills have much lower doses of hormones. The risks are much lower. But the safety concerns then led to congressional hearings on pill safety. So tell us, what happened as a result of Dr. Seaman's work?
She wrote a book that was a bestseller called The Doctor's Case Against the Pill. It was published in 1969, and it lit the fire that became the Nelson hearings on the safety and efficacy of oral contraceptives. That was a congressional hearing that lasted from January through March of 1970, and it was scandalous in some ways, in that one of the things that Nelson and his colleagues forgot to do was to invite a single woman in the United States to testify. And in one of those kind of legendary comments, Bob Dole, who was on that particular committee, said that he was concerned that if women were apprised of some of the negative side effects of the pill, that we'd all be in trouble, because not only would they take oral contraceptives, they'd need to take tranquilizers too.
Oh boy, that little patronizing there. But women were angry about, there were women saying, why are you using women as guinea pigs? Why are you letting the drug companies murder us for profit and convenience? These were feminists. I mean, there were questions about the safety of the pill, and it fell from favor for a little while. There was also the time, I just want to have mentioned this, and I think 1967, when the Pittsburgh branch of the NAACP charged that Planned Parenthood clinics, which were providing the pill and other forms of birth control in low-income neighborhoods, that this was a form of racial genocide.
Yes, there were a lot of African-American activists, including Martin Luther King and Malcolm X, who at least had some, you know, concerns about why is it that at a moment in American history when African Americans have finally been given more civil rights, that we suddenly are being encouraged to have poor women and women of color taking a pill that will prevent the African American population from expanding. Although, as you know, what I found in my book, women continue to use it anyway.
Birth control pills still have some risks. Last year, the FDA reprimanded Bayer, which made Yaz. That was the pill that was marketed to treat PMS and acne, and it had some risks. And there's still a rate of unintended pregnancies of 49% of all pregnancies, far higher than many other industrialized nations. So, you know, the pill is out there, but it doesn't seem to be forestalling unintended pregnancies.
No, I think that's a really good point. I mean, the United States does have one of the highest unwanted pregnancy rates in the Western world. It also has one of the highest chlamydia and HIV/AIDS rates among young people who are sexually active. The estimate is that half of all Americans will get a sexually transmitted disease or infection at some time in their lives.
How do you square the fact that the pill is, you know, covered by insurance companies? We have the new push by the Obama administration for employers, all employers except those at religious institutions, to provide free birth control in their insurance plans to employees. With the fact that there are so many unintended pregnancies, Kay Himnowitz of the Conservative Manhattan Institute, she says, surveys show that only a very small percentage of moms cite lack of access to birth control as a factor in their pregnancy. Kay Himnowitz and others say it's a tepid interest in family planning. I mean, that's provocative language, I know, but, you know, they're saying providing it, the pill isn't the answer.
Yeah, I'm not entirely convinced by that. This is where it would be useful for the United States to look at the success of family planning programs in other countries and to say, well, what are they doing that we're not doing? I'm concerned that people aren't getting the right education. You know, we have a country where you still have, in a lot of high schools, abstinence-only programs. Maybe the pill is available in a same city or area. That availability means much less if you haven't been educated as to how to use them.
So we have this huge timeline, but it's actually a very short amount of time. And as we've said, very recent history. And I was struck when the debates over birth control came up, we were being reminded that it was the Republican president, Richard Nixon, who declared, you know, contraceptives for all. And, you know, just seemed like a different time. You know, just your sense of the history of the pill in general, how controversial it has been.
Well, it has been surprisingly controversial in the United States and much less so in other places. It's still the number one used method of reversible birth control in the United States. I think, though, that this history of what is the right thing to do ethically and medically, and what's the right thing for a woman to do for herself, is still unwritten. I would like to see it get some closure and resolution soon, so that, yes, that Nixon, I can't believe I'm saying this, that Richard Nixon's great dream on this matter would come to fruition. That hasn't been achieved yet.
Dr. Andrea Tone, Professor of History and Canada Research Chair in the Social History of Medicine at McGill University in Montreal, also author of Devices and Desires, A History of Contraceptives in America. Andrea, thanks so much.
Thank you.